Okay. So I guess Rabbi Kalman, since you're the only one who's not muted, can you see the, you can see the
Yes, I can see it.
slideshow? Okay.
Okay.
Great. Okay. So, hi out there, everyone. This is, it's a great pleasure for me, and I thank Rabbi Kalman for giving me the opportunity. It's also a little strange for me to be speaking to no one, if you will, or to be speaking to my computer screen. So hopefully we'll be able to manage that awkwardness. I chose tonight's topic because there's some obvious relevance. It's a topic that I think is critically important in general, but as we grapple with the impact of the medical circumstances, the scientific circumstances that we find ourselves in, and at the same time struggling to figure out how what place our faith and our general approach to Torah fits in, I think it brings to the fore a very fundamental question that's been asked, I think sometimes been grappled with, but at least from my perspective, not sufficiently. So what I want to do with you tonight is kind of revisit the question of Torah and science, Torah and Mada. It's been framed in a number of different ways. So on this first slide, you can see faith versus reason is a catchphrase that's used. And in 2005, about 15 years ago, this issue really rocked the Orthodox community, partially because a very, very bright and articulate young rabbi named Rabbi Natan Slifkin published a book and some articles where he attempted to reconcile the most current of scientific theory with the Torah, essentially explaining how certain things that may have been thought to be a given from a Torah perspective, if you will, were really incompatible with contemporary scientific fact, and therefore needed to be reevaluated, if you will. And not surprisingly, the response was his works were banned in the Haredi community, even though he himself really came from that world. And it touched off a firestorm of bans. And it wasn't just Natan Slifkin whose work was banned and underwent a whole bunch of scrutiny. But there were a number of articles even on Aish.com, right? Now, remember, we're talking about Aish.com, certainly very mainstream. And a number of articles were pulled off the website. And what the explanation that was given is that they had to be reviewed by leading Torah scholars because evidently they were found to contain similar heresies, if you will. And a number of those articles have never been reposted to the website. I went looking for a few of them. I have a few of them. I've consulted a few of them over the years. And in fact, many of them were never put back onto the website. Just to give you an example of how deep this went, we're not talking about articles by fringe elements that were pulled off the website. One of the authors whose works were pulled, just to give you a quick gap at the bottom of the page there, this is an author who studied at Chaim Berlin Lake and Meir, but also received a degree in microbiology. And I guess there's the Toronto connection here, an MA in political science, was a senior lecturer at Yeshiva Eish HaTorah, and also wrote an article really grappling with scientific fact and reality and the traditional Torah approach or the traditional approach to reading the Torah and creation science. And his article also was deemed not inappropriate and was pulled as well. And that, so in the Haredi world, there is a clear dichotomy between science and traditional time-honored Torah approaches to some of these topics. And so when these two things come into conflict, one has to give way, and it's going to be modern science that gives way. Anyone who suggests otherwise is said to be essentially heretical, and their works have been either banned or removed from circulation. In our community, I would say the more centrist community, we have not resorted to this type of either or approach, right? We have a phrase that adorns the flagship of modern Orthodoxy in Yeshiva University called Torah Umada, that somehow we believe in a synthesis. We believe that there can and must be traditional Torah study and approaches. And at the same time, we also value science. And this comes as a surprise to anyone. In our day schools for upwards of 12 years, we teach our children Torah and we teach them Mada. And presumably we teach them that there is no conflict between them. The problem is, at least from my perspective, that while we validate independently Torah, and we validate Mada, and we teach Torah, and we teach Mada, we're missing a very critical step that I would call integration. There's too much of a dichotomy that exists between, if you will, the studies we do in the morning and the studies we do in the afternoon. Obviously, it doesn't have to be that way, but just for illustration's sake. And this poses, I think, a huge set of problems for our community that I think we would be wise to address. Okay, so I'm trying to figure out how to deal with questions that are popping up. I guess I have to unmute someone. Let's see. Okay. Question?
It's very difficult to understand you. Your voice is cracking up. It's almost impossible to understand. Ellie Melech said something about your Wi-Fi.
Are okay. Other people having a problem?
Yes.
Also?
Okay, hi. I go now. I reclaim the host. Hopefully this will help. I apologize to everybody. Keep going. I'll let you know if there's a problem.
Okay, will do. So I think there are three problems that emerge from our inability thus far as a community to figure out the integration between Torah and Mada. How are we doing, Rabbi Kelman? Can you guys hear me?
Yes, that was a lot better. That was a lot better.
Okay, great. Okay, so let's frame these three problems. Number one is there's a certain loss of integrity on our part when we say we believe in Torah and we say we believe in Mada, but we aren't able to create an integration between them, and we kind of land up having to believe in two things that seem to be contradictory. That's not a healthy worldview. And where that really comes to the fore is, let's say, in our college campuses with our young people. Okay, so just to frame for you, when we have yeshiva graduates who go through 12 years of of day school education, and then maybe they go to Israel, and they come back representing our community. They go to college, and then at least into the semester, Rosh Hashanah is coming, and the college professor decides it's an opportunity to assert his or her intellectual superiority, and calls on a Jewish student and says, okay, so I understand you're going to be out, you know, next week, you're celebrating Rosh Hashanah. So it's the anniversary of creation, and exactly how many years has it been since the creation of the world? And the student says, 5,780 years. And that student now, for the first time in their life, realizes that if they maintain to their professor, so the professor says, do you really believe the world created 5,780 years ago? And now all of a sudden this student realizes that either they're going to maintain this belief and say to the professor, yes, I really do believe that. That's what my religious tradition teaches me. And they can be the subject of ridicule on the part of their colleagues and peers, or they can say, no, obviously this is a biology class and we know the world is 15 billion years old. And then they'll have to explain why they hold on to this seemingly infantile notion that the world is 5,780 years old. Can they explain to their professor? Can they give a coherent explanation of how they can fully believe in the science that they're studying and maintain in their integrity, their spiritual integrity, and explain why the year that we're celebrating is 5780? I would suspect, and based on my own experiences, that very few of our yeshiva graduates can actually do that in any sort of coherent way. And this starts them on the path of really questioning what's the integrated worldview? How do these things that they have been told, this Torah and Mada, that they've been told are both true and both to be valued, when they seemingly come into conflict and they have no tools, no ability to resolve it, it creates, I think, a serious problem. And then when they come home for Yom Tov and they start raising some of these questions at home and realize that their parents don't necessarily have answers either, I think it's the beginning of a very serious process of questioning that does not usually end in a good place. Okay. Secondly, the inability to really integrate Torah and Mada, I think, has really crippled our community when it comes to medical halacha, in particular, end of life issues. And then thirdly, which is very much germane to our current situation, the inability to really integrate these two things, I think, causes some very serious concerns and problems when it comes to public health policy for within the Orthodox Jewish community. Now, numbers 2 and 3, I'm going to deal with. This is really part one of a two-part series. It was supposed to be last week and this week, and I apologize we couldn't do it last week, but we'll figure out when to schedule the second part. And that's when I'd like to deal with some of the halachic issues and the public health issues. What I really want to deal with today is to kind of go back to the basics and just to understand how it is that we grapple with the notion of Torah and Mada, and particularly where science and traditional Torah approaches seem to conflict with one another. So this conflict usually frames itself in two fundamental challenges. The first is the age of the universe, which I referenced already, right? On the one hand, as Torah Jews, we celebrate the anniversary of the world each year on Rosh Hashanah. When we write our dates, we write that the world is 5,780 years old. At the same time, as Madaists, as modern Jews, who truly do believe in science, many of us make our careers in science, all of us utilize modern science and rely on it on a daily basis, that same science in its most elementary form suggests and in many ways has proven that the universe is 15 billion years old. That's not a small margin of error. Which is it? And what happens when we're caught in that conflict? And then the second is the theory of evolution. Right now, we'll refer to evolution in its kind of macro perspective. There are many different sub-theories of evolution, each of which is worth discussing unto itself, but we will accept, as modern science does, the general principle and theory of evolution that species have evolved over millions and billions of years from far more simplistic organisms into the much more complex organisms that we see today. Okay, that is a fundamental truth of science. And we might be led to believe, if we read many of the articles that exist, that this stands in contrast to what the Torah teaches us, which is that the universe and species came into being when God, if you will, snapped his fingers and said, let there be man. And thus human beings were created some, again, 5,780 years ago. Okay, so these are the two fundamental challenges that'll frame our conversation. It's a conversation that we could probably go on with for weeks, but we'll try to focus the conversation into the time that we have left. Again, the purpose of giving you an approach and a framework that I think will be helpful moving forward. Okay, so at the bottom of this page is Lucy, right? I'm sure some of you have met up with Lucy at the Museum of Natural History. And the description, right? Lucy's one of the most complete skeletons found to date from the early hominids that flourished between 4 and 2 million years ago, right? So about 3.2 million years old. So what do we as Torah Jews, what do we make of Lucy? Is she an ancestor of ours? Is that compatible with our notion of mankind having been created B'Tselem Elokim? So let's take a look at some of the sources and some of the fundamental ideas that I think frame this conversation. So if you haven't kind of figured out where I'm going to go with this to begin with, I think the entire notion of the conflict between Torah and Mada is in many ways, you might want to call it a straw man. It's a conflict that is set up, that much has been written about, but I think fundamentally the conflict really doesn't exist. Okay, and here's why. So let's look at the Rambam famously has a two-pronged approach to religious and spiritual knowledge, if you will. Okay, I'm not sure we have time to go through each of these sources, but suffice it to say, the Rambam in one place says that the way to know and love God is to study his commandments, right? God gave us a whole book of commandments as to how we should act, moral positions that we should adopt. And if you want to understand God and come to an appreciation of God, then you study those mitzvot and you get a pretty good idea of what God's value system is all about and what he therefore expects of us. At the same time, the Rambam also writes, Maimonides also writes, very differently, that the way to gain an appreciation for God is to study his creations and his works, that which he brought into being. And the Kinat Sofrim, one of the earliest commentators on the Rambam's Sefer HaMitzvot, the Rambam's elucidation of the 613 mitzvot, is very keen to pick up on the fact that Rambam has two different discussions of what the religious pursuit should look like. And he writes that the reason Rambam omits from his Mishneh Torah any discussion of studying Hashem's mitzvot, it doesn't mean he omits it entirely, but from this particular passage where he talks about how to arrive at appreciation of God, in that particular passage, he mentions only studying his works and his wondrous creations, explains Rav Hananya Kazis. That's because he's talking about the study of creation, the study of science. And the study of mitzvot is part of a separate activity, namely the study of Torah, which Rambam elaborates on separately. And what the Kinat Sofrim is just bringing into focus is that the Rambam writes that there's two different ways to gain an appreciation of God. One is by studying his Torah, his statutes, his laws, his values, the narrative of God's relationship with his people. And the other is essentially by studying science, by studying that which God brought into the world. And by studying that which God brought into existence, one comes to a great religious and spiritual appreciation for God and God's immense power, knowledge, and abilities. And that really gets us thinking, so what is the purpose of Torah and the Torah text that we have? When we open the Torah in the beginning and we study the book of Bereishit, are we studying science or are we studying Torah? And I think the answer is we're studying Torah because Torah is meant to be studied from a text that God gave us. Science is meant to be studied as science is studied, by observing the universe around us, by deducing and theorizing, and all the modern methodologies of science that have evolved over the centuries. But one certainly doesn't study science by studying the text of the Torah. And I think that's a really important point for us to understand. The Torah is not a book of science. The Torah is a book of values that is primarily consists of God's telling us what he expects of us, but of course also contains a narrative of God's evolving relationship with the Jewish people, because that's also very important for us to understand who we are and what's expected of us. But the Torah is not a book of science. Now, that doesn't mean that the Torah doesn't reference natural phenomena. Of course it does. No text that speaks to a human experience and an experience in this world could possibly not refer to the natural world that we inhabit, nor is there any reason to think that the Torah doesn't speak about our relationship to that natural world. But that's very different from suggesting that the Torah is there to teach us science, because it most definitely is not. And that's part of what the Rambam means when he talks about the study of Torah on the one hand and the study of science on the other. Okay, so let's see how that plays out if we keep that in mind. Okay, so if the Torah is not a book of science, then Rashi's question at the very beginning of the Torah takes on even more urgency, right? Rashi has a famous question the beginning of Bereishit, why does the Torah have to even bother with all this? If the Torah is a book of law, why not begin with the very first mitzvah in the Torah, which very relevant to where we sit today, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, the creation of Rosh Chodesh, and then Korban Pesach, and the whole story of Yitziat Mitzrayim. Right? Why bother starting with creation? So here's where a lot of people fall into the trap. Well, obviously, it's to teach us the science of the universe. And I would suggest that, no, that's not true at all. The Torah starts with the story of creation because it is endeavoring to do that which the Torah does, namely, help us understand our place in the universe and help us understand our relationship with God and help us understand something about God's governance of the universe. If we want to understand the science behind it, we ought to take up the scientific study of the universe, which we should, but that is not the same as studying the text of the Torah. So I actually want to spend a little bit of time with you studying the first chapter of Bereishit and trying to understand what the Torah is trying to teach us. And then a lot of the conflict that we have, I think, will start to dissipate. And instead, I think a much more user-friendly rubric of how we see the Torah and science will begin to emerge. Okay, so let's read through the beginning of Bereishit, not focusing on science, but focusing on a text, because that's what the Torah is. It's a text, and it's meant to be studied in a literary fashion. Okay, so the first thing we should note is, part of the problem with, part of the alleged challenge and conflict between Torah and science is that it seems like the Torah is suggesting that the world was created in 6 days, right? After Ki Sheishet Yamim Asa Hashem Et HaShemayim V'et HaAretz. The Torah says it straight out, the world was created in 6 days. If you offer that up to a scientist, they will say that is patently ridiculous and false. The world did not come into being, into a world that we know of today, in 6 days. And so it sounds like right from the beginning, we are off on the wrong foot and we have a problem. But of course, the problem really is that we approach the reading and the study of Bereishit as scientists. And we can't help ourselves because we live in a scientific age. We live in a society that really demands a scientific explanation to everything. And so we tend to read things scientifically, okay? But that's really not fair if the text that we're reading is not a scientific text, okay? So let's get a couple of ground rules kind of under our belts before we start. How long did it actually take for the world to be created? So yes, I'm well aware that the Torah says it happened in 6 days. And how long was one of those days? And here I wish we... people, I like talking to myself for such a long time, but I can't tell you how long each day of creation was, but I'm pretty sure I can tell you how long it wasn't. Okay, and the reason I feel so confident is because when we say that the Torah was created in 6 days, we, as the scientists that we are, immediately think, okay, well, a day is 24 hours. And so 6 days is 6 times 24. And that seventh day is a week, exactly like we have today, right? And it kind of transposes our own experience of time and the patterns of our lives and working for 6 days and resting on a seventh, and just imposes that on the whole creation story, right? But I'm fairly confident telling you that I know for a fact that the days that are referenced in the creation story are not 24-hour days. And the reason I know that is because what makes a day 24 hours is a scientific phenomenon, namely the revolution of the Earth on its axis with respect to the sun. That takes 24 hours to occur, and therefore a day in our lives is a full revolution of the Earth on its axis. But of course, in the first day of creation and the second day of creation and the third day of creation, the Torah is already referencing the term Yom Echad, right? And then Yom Sheni. The Torah is using the term day one and day two, but it can't possibly mean 24 hours, because 24 hours is an irrelevant number in day one, if you will, or day two or day three of creation, because according to the narrative, the sun itself didn't come into being until day four. So whatever Yom means when it is introduced in the creation story, there's absolutely no reason for us to think that it refers to a 24-hour period. A 24-hour period is a scientific phenomenon that has to do with the relationship of the Earth to the sun. If the sun wasn't, quote, created yet, but the Torah is using the term Yom, then I'm fairly confident that whatever the term Yom means, it has nothing to do with the sun, and it has nothing to do with a 24-hour period. And if that's the case, then there's no reason to think that throughout the story, when the Torah uses the refrain, Vayihi Erev, Vayihi Boker, Yom Echad, one day, that day refers to a scientific 24-hour period. Okay, so I'm pretty confident that that's not what the word day means, and that 6 days of creation does not mean 6 24-hour period. Okay, so what is a day in the creation story? So here I'm going to ask you to do some textual analysis with me. Okay, so you can use your own chumash or you can use the text that I'm providing here, but I want you to take a minute and look at each day of creation and tell me if you can determine a repeating pattern. There's a structure. Every single day of creation has an internal structure and pattern to it. I'll give you a hint. It's a four-tiered pattern. There's four components to the pattern. Every day has it. And see if you can figure out what it is. It's obviously text-based, but once you latch on to the key phrases in the text, you'll then have to figure out what each component is. So I'll give you just a couple of minutes to take a look at it, and then we'll go through it together. So I don't know if Rabbi Kelman can help us with this, but does anyone want to either physically raise their hand or use the raise your hand function and share with us the pattern that you're seeing? If it's too difficult, we can skip over it, much as I'd love to involve everybody.
If anybody wants to speak, they can raise their hand. I can unmute you. Okay, Ravari, take it away.
Okay, we'll do this together. All right. So each day of creation has the following patterns. First of all, Bereshit starts with an introduction. Okay, the first pasuk is just a general, right? God is the creator. Our point of origin is that the world was tohu vavohu. The world was chaos and randomness. Let's just call it that. Chaos and randomness. That's our starting point. And now, look what the Torah introduces us to. Each day has four parts to it. The first is an agenda. Okay? God says, this is my plan for the day. The second component is implementation. The third is evaluation. And the fourth is summation. Okay? And the truth is, anyone who creates an agenda or a strategic plan, these are the basic components, right? What do I intend to do? What's my goal? How do I implement it? I need to evaluate it, and then I need to summarize it, and I need to move on. Okay, every single day of creation has the exact same pattern. You can see I color coded them, right? The green is the agenda, purple is implementation, blue is evaluation, gray is summation. Every single day of creation has the exact same internal structure, okay? And the sixth day has an interesting double structure, okay? It's still the same structure, but it's a structure that repeats itself twice because the sixth day has an added component of the creation of humankind. We'll leave that be for a second, okay? So what's the first thing that we learn from the beginning of Sefer Bereshit? What we learn is that the default status of the universe is chaos and randomness, and that God brought order to that chaos and randomness, and he did it in six distinct units. Okay, right? We could have had one narrative where God said, here's my agenda. I'm going to create a world. Look at the world that I created. Isn't it fantastic? But that's not what the Torah communicates to us. The Torah communicates to us that God went through a systematic, multi-layered, multi-cyclical pattern of creating the world, starting from chaos and randomness, and through a purposeful organization, brought a measure of order to it, and he did it in stages. Okay, that's the first thing that we learn from the text of the Torah. And let me see if I want to jump ahead for a second. That's not a good idea because I'm going to give away some of our stuff. Okay, so what I'll do is, I'll just give you something that's going to come, I think, in a future slide. But just to emphasize this idea of starting from chaos and God bringing order to the universe. So the notion of Vayihi Erev, Vayihi Boker, Yom Echad is, again, can be very confusing for us because we think of it in modern scientific terms. Oh, it was evening and then it was morning. And that was one day. We read it literally. But Ibn Ezra, who is very sensitive to the language of the Sukkim, in the very first day of creation, he explains, what does Erev and Boker mean? And then his need to explain that is because he wants to make sure you don't think of this as the typical evening and morning of a 24-hour day. He explains that Erev comes from the Hebrew shoresh that's similar to mi'urav, which means mixed up. Things are mixed up. They're not discernible. There's a lack of clarity and organization. And he explains that the word boker comes from the same Hebrew word as a bikur, which means an investigation. When you conduct an investigation, you're trying to take essentially chaos and sort it into clarity. And you're trying to make distinctions. You're trying to bring out the facts from its background. And so Ibn Ezra explains that the summation of each day of creation is just a restatement of what God is actually doing here. Vayhi erev, vayhi boker, means God successfully at each stage of creation, successfully moved the world from some measure of chaos, mi'urav, erev, to boker, to clarity. Okay, and this is God's intervention, right? And then the laws that God introduces to the world, these are the forces that bring about clarity and organization. This is what the first parak of Bereishit is teaching us. Okay. So now let's go a little bit further. What else do we learn from the beginning of Bereishit? So the first thing we saw was a purposeful organization of creation. Second, if we look not at the internal pattern, but if we just take the 6 days of creation as a whole, what sense do we get? If we look at what was created on the first day and we look at what was created on the sixth day, what sense do we get of the movement of all this? There's a movement of Erev to Boker, not just within each day, but from the beginning of the process till the end of the process. It begins with the building blocks of the universe, light, dark, energy, water, land, and it progresses each day with things becoming more sophisticated until eventually the last thing that's created is the human being, which we view as the most sophisticated of God's creatures. Okay, so if we look at the pattern again, the Torah is suggesting to us that the way God's world evolves, if you will, is from simple forms to more complex forms, and that's actually by God's own design. But if we look a little bit deeper, there are more complex relationships in the first parak of Bereishit. So I like to call this habitat and habitant. Okay, I don't know if that's really great English, but it's catchy. Okay, and here's what I mean. In addition to there being a linear progression from day one to day six, there's a much more complex relationship amongst the days of creation. Okay, so for example, if you break the 6 days of creation into two columns, what you'll see is that the first 3 days of creation, what God creates is essentially habitats. Okay? And I use that term loosely. So day one is God creates day and night. And then what happens on day four? Right? On day four, the habitants of day and night are created. So you have the sun and the moon. Okay, now let's see again, if we could do this interactively, it would be much more stimulating. But on day two, right, God also creates habitats. He creates water, the sea, and he creates the sky, right? That's day two. Sea and sky, a separation of water. And what's created on day five? The inhabitants of the sea and the sky. The Torah tells us on day five that God created the fish and the fowl. On day three, God creates dry land. That's the habitat. And on day six, God creates terrestrial creatures, those who inhabit the dry land. So in addition to a simple linear pattern of one through six, there are also more complex patterns in the first chapter of Bereshit, where you have a group of day one, day two, and day three, where God is creating habitats, and then day four, day five, and day six, where God is creating those entities that will inhabit those particular realms. Now, we wouldn't necessarily see that at first glance. If you read through the first parak, it's pretty easy to grasp the simple linear progress, right? Any of our kids early on in day school can figure out that we're moving from light and dark to the creation of mankind. That's a linear progression. But it takes a little bit of study and analysis in order to pick up on some of these patterns that exist behind the scenes. And that too is a very important message of the first parak of Bereshit, and that is that God's universe can be appreciated by simply going outside, looking around and observing, and anyone can do that. And at the same time, if you, with a little bit of training and a little bit of study and a little bit of analysis, if you apply those skills to God's universe, there are all kinds of patterns, but that we typically refer to as science and the laws of nature, all kinds of things begin to emerge, all kinds of different relationships and patterns that allow you to actually predict, right? Once I see what happens from day one to day four and day two to day five, I can predict the relationship between day three and day six. And that's what our universe is about in terms of our study of it, right? That we can, the first chapter of Bereshit is not telling us the science. It's not telling us how something was created. It's telling us what our relationship to God's universe ought to be. First of all, in what purposeful way did God create it? And how we should be approaching it, what's there for us to discover. Okay, so here's what we talked about with 24 hours and the Ramban and Ibn Ezra about Erev and Boker. Okay, so now let's move on to another topic. So just to sum up, if the days of creation are not scientific days, they're not 24-hour periods. Rather, each one is an era. It's a segment of creation. And in that segment of creation, God essentially developed the building blocks of the universe, and he did it in a systematic, organized way that's got linear patterns, it's got repeating patterns, and the emphasis is that the universe had a master designer, and not just a master designer that on a whim snapped his fingers and everything came into creation, but rather the first chapter of Bereshit actually tells us that God put laws and patterns and things that repeat. That's how he programmed the universe, because that's what emerges from the first chapter of Bereshit. Now, Rosh Hashanah. So we celebrate Rosh Hashanah as the anniversary of creation. Chazal, in many different places, have a recurring theme that seems at first glance to be strange. So if I asked you, if Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of the year, right, and it's the anniversary of creation, we say Hayom Harat Olam, today is the anniversary of creation. So if I asked you, you would probably say that the first day of creation corresponds to the first day of the year. That's what Rosh Hashanah means. It's the anniversary of the first day of creation. But numerous places in Chazal, in rabbinic literature, there's an emphasis that Rosh Hashanah is actually the anniversary of the sixth day of creation, not the first day of creation. Now, it's kind of it's a strange thing. How could Rosh Hashanah be the anniversary of the sixth day of creation? So you mean the world actually started, right? If we allegorically refer to these days as 6 days, so then the beginning of the world started on Chaf Hei Elul. It's very strange. And you look at it and you kind of wonder, what were Chazal trying to do by emphasizing that Rosh Hashanah marks the sixth day of creation and not the first day of creation? And in fact, some of our practices, this is the sidebar, some of our practices actually reflect this. And so when we start saying Slichot, we always start saying Slichot on Sunday, right? So it's like the beginning of Slichot, we want to correspond to the beginning of the creative process. But as long as Rosh Hashanah falls out on Thursday or Friday, then we start on Sunday morning and we have that one short week of Slichot. And the reason for that minhag is because we want to start Slichot on Sunday, because after all, the first day of creation was Sunday, but we actually want Rosh Hashanah to fall out on Friday. So as long as Rosh Hashanah is Thursday or Friday, Rosh Hashanah will fall out on Friday because there's 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. Why is it important for Rosh Hashanah to fall out on Friday and for us to have that number of Slichot? Because that helps us, it helps us draw attention to the fact that really Rosh Hashanah is an anniversary of the sixth day of creation. What does it mean, Rosh Hashanah is the sixth day of creation? Well, what it means is that we're actually celebrating the creation of mankind and not the creation of the scientific universe, the creation of mankind. And so when we keep this anniversary of years every year on Rosh Hashanah, it's less about the scientific world than it is about the creation of mankind. What does it mean? What do we mean by the creation of mankind? Well, if you think about what we talked about earlier, if the Torah is not a book of science, but really fundamentally, the Torah is a book of the relationship between God and mankind. And it's a guidebook for us to understand what it is that we're supposed to do. So the thing that we're celebrating on Rosh Hashanah is not a scientific celebration. It celebrates the beginning of the relationship between God and mankind. That's really, and that's why Rosh Hashanah is Yom HaDin. When you start a relationship, any relationship then has accountability, it has expectations and mutual responsibilities. So on the anniversary of that relationship, it makes sense to reflect on how are we fulfilling our different responsibilities. That's what Rosh Hashanah is. It's not an Arbor Day. It's not a scientific, it's not about the science of the universe. It's about the relationship between God and mankind. So when Rosh Hashanah comes about, now we say, so 5,780 years ago, mankind was created. So let's see if we can deal with that for just a couple of minutes that we have left. So if the way that the Torah actually lays out creation, it actually points very much towards evolution. Right? After all, the Torah's account of creation is a movement of from simplicity to sophistication, right? And that's what the theory of evolution essentially posits, right? So where does that leave mankind? Once we understand that each day of creation is a unit of organization and not a 24-hour period, then there's no limit to how long that process could have taken, right? That process easily could have taken millions and billions of years for God to organize each era. And we know that scientifically that evolution has occurred in different stages and phases, many of which are named and categorized. So what does science posit in terms of the development of mankind? So obviously there's an evolution from let's say from certain species that descended from apes, right? You're all familiar with this. So at what point do we become human? Well, the Torah itself purposefully includes the animal kingdom and mankind on the same day. We're both created on the sixth day. It didn't have to be that way. We should just take note, right? God has six different days of creation. He could easily have separated us, but he didn't. The animal kingdom is created on the sixth day. Mankind is created on the sixth day. But if you look back at day six, you see that the Torah distinguished between there's 6A and there's 6B. Because at a certain point, this species called mankind is distinguished from the other species. What distinguishes it? So the way the Torah describes it is that God created mankind in his image. And in Perek Bet, it more vividly describes God endowing mankind with a particular spirit. We think of that as a soul, right? And what exactly does that mean? What distinguishes mankind from the rest of the animal kingdom? We're more than quantitatively just more sophisticated and more evolved. There are certain things qualitatively that distinguish humankind from the animal kingdom. That's been discussed in sociology and scientific literature. But one of the primary distinctions that separates mankind from the animal kingdom, it's not language. There are many species that have their own language and communicate verbally. But it would seem that mankind is the only species that has developed written language. And that higher intelligence of communicating by written language and a system of symbols, that seems to be one of the things that distinguishes mankind from other species. Interestingly enough, in the history of the development of intelligence, wouldn't you know that written language, the earliest form of written language, can be traced to about 5,500 years ago. That's the earliest form of written language that scientists have been able to discover. And so what I think emerges is that, sure, there was Lucy and there was a whole bunch, we have a whole bunch of ancestors after Lucy. They were part of God's creation of land animals on the sixth day. That sixth day of creation took millions of years to evolve. And then at a certain point, this species evolved to the point where God said, either now this species is ready to be elevated amongst other species to be able to have a relationship with me and to take its place in the creation hierarchy. And so I'm now going to have a relationship with mankind. I'm going to endow mankind. I'm going to grace mankind with a relationship and endow mankind with a divine image. And that is what we record as having happened 5,780 years ago. Okay. It's not a scientific date. What is the date 5,780? Did anyone ever stop and think about, well, where did we get that from? It's really very simple. If we look at the recorded relationship that exists between God and mankind, namely the Torah, and we trace back the generations, what we get is a history of relationship between God and mankind. It goes back 5,780 years ago, which according to scientists is approximately, it corresponds to a time stamp of a significant advance in mankind's intelligence. So when we celebrate Rosh Hashanah and say this is the anniversary, 5,780 years, yes, that's exactly what we mean. Because what we're celebrating is our relationship with God. There is nothing in the world of science that contradicts the fact that we have a documented relationship with God that goes back 5,780 years. And there's nothing in the Torah that contradicts the fact that the universe itself and pre-Homo sapien man and all kinds of other species existed millions and millions of years ago. What it comes down to is what we started with. Studying the universe is a very important endeavor. Rambam thinks it's critical, right? We study the universe through scientific lenses. What we get is a universe that's 15 billion years old, that evolved through various theories of evolution, that went through phases of what you might call prehistoric man. Those are all absolutely 100% true. And the text of the Torah, while not teaching us the actual science, definitely is supportive of that type of an evolutionary history. But that's the study of science. And it's absolutely true, it's absolutely valuable, and it's absolutely part of the religious endeavor. But on the other hand, we have the Torah aspect of things. The Torah aspect of things is our relationship with God. That's not a scientific phenomenon. That is something that we have a record of, that we treasure. And our record of that relationship with God goes back 5,780 years ago. So when Chazal said to always keep in mind that Rosh Hashanah is a celebration of the sixth day of creation and not the first day of creation, what they're essentially telling us is that Rosh Hashanah is not a celebration of the world of science. Rather, it's a celebration of the relationship between God and the Jewish people. If we had more time, I would take you through a text, an absolutely magnificent text called the Drush Or Chaim by the Tiferet Yisrael. Tiferet Yisrael is one of the most famous and popular commentaries on the Mishnah. He was a Lithuanian rabbi, died in the year 1860, which is significant because it means that at the height of his writing in the 1830s and 40s, he was essentially privy to some of the great milestones in evolutionary science and geology and some of the great discoveries of fossils and layers of preserved relics all occurred at the very end of the 1700s and the early 1800s. And he actually references discoveries in the Zoological Museum in St. Petersburg in Russia. He refers to the woolly mammoth discovered outside of Baltimore, which was something that actually occurred in the year 1801. He refers to a couple of the most famous biologists and geologists of the time, like Cuvier. And this is all from a Lithuanian rabbi of Danzig. And some of the things that he writes, if you thought that Rabbi Natan Slifkin would be put in a cheirem, reading the Tefer Yisrael is absolutely amazing. I mean, he says things like there were humans that preceded Adam, right? I mean, try walking into even an Orthodox day school and saying, well, was Adam the first creature that resembled a human being? No, Adam was the first to be endowed with a divine spark. Adam marks the pinnacle of the creation of man to a point where God felt it was time to have a relationship with him. And he writes all of these marvelous discoveries, the Tefer Yisrael, all these marvelous discoveries only serve to highlight the complexity and the brilliance of God's universe. He's so comfortable pointing to science exactly as Rambam did, as a parallel means of discovering God and marveling at God's universe. And then I also put here on this slide Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. So Hirsch writing in the latter half of the 19th century was really already dealing with the origin of species and Darwin and theories that were just getting started and were certainly not proven to the same extent that they are today. But let's look at what Hirsch writes. Hirsch says, this will never change, not even if the latest scientific notion of the genesis of all multitudes of organic forms on Earth can be traced back to one single most primitive primeval form of life, should ever appear to be anything more than what it is today, a vague hypothesis still unsupported by fact. Okay, so Hirsch wasn't convinced, as much of the world wasn't, that this was correct. But look at what he says. Even if this notion were ever to gain complete acceptance by the scientific world, Jewish thought, in that case, would call upon its adherents to give even greater reverence than ever before to the one sole God who in his boundless creative wisdom and eternal omnipotence needed to bring into existence no more than one single amorphous nucleus and one single law of adaptation and heredity in order to bring forth from what seemed chaos but was in fact a very definite order the infinite variety of species we know today, each with its unique characteristic that sets it apart from all other creatures. What's really important about Hirsch's formulation is the lack of fear that he has in these scientific discoveries, right? So even if this new groundbreaking, earth-shattering theory were to be correct, that's not a problem. You don't see Hirsch running away from these theories. We would just incorporate that scientific theory, and if it were proven, it will become yet another scientific observation of the world that increases our wonder and appreciation of God and poses absolutely no threat to the notion of God as master creator. It merely testifies to the brilliance of the laws and the structure that God imposed upon the universe that would enable it to go from this one origin of species, if you will, to the variety of species that we know today. So just to bring this to a close and to summarize, and I purposefully laid this out as the kind of the groundwork for a more, for an exploration of more detailed halacha and public policy that I'd like to do in the next class. But I think it's really hard to have that conversation without getting more comfortable with the idea that in our tradition, we have two separate forms of appreciating God. One is through the Torah and the mitzvot that God laid out for us, a system of law, a system of value, a system of morals by which we live our lives. And the second is the great universe that God created. And just like we've developed over the years methodologies for deriving law and halakha, and those methodologies, we say that Torah and Torah way of life is everlasting precisely because it was endowed with these methodologies that allow us to maintain a relevance through thick and thin and through a changing world. The same thing is true about science. We're constantly evolving methodologies and discoveries, and none of them threaten the Torah, because as long as we understand that Torah is not a book of science. And I just want to conclude with this. Why then, if this is so simple, why then is faith and reason, Torah and science, so often held up as contradictory? Why were so many of these books banned just in 2005? What's the fear? And that has really a historical answer to it. And that's because in the evolution of theology and science and reason, essentially religion held a monopoly over explaining the phenomena of the world for a very long time. And the Rambam is incredibly advanced in his own age in terms of his scientific exploration. Most of the rest of the world doesn't catch up in any meaningful way until the 17th and 18th centuries. And when science does come on the scene, in some circles that were looking to free themselves of the yoke and the control and the domination of religious institutions, in particular the Catholic Church, so science was introduced as an alternative to religion, as a new way of explaining the phenomena of the world and why things happen without having to resort to the demands of religion. That was incredibly threatening to established religion, incredibly threatening to the Catholic Church, right? We all know the stories of Galileo and the various different heresies that the church was threatened by. But at the end of the day, science wins every time, because it's not a threat. It's only a problem when people perceive it to be a threat. And there were establishments in Judaism that perceived as well science to be an alternative. And in modern day, starting with the Enlightenment in the 19th century and continuing in America, there are those for whom science provides an alternative. And established religion is sometimes views that fearfully and therefore created this dichotomy that it's either science or Torah. But our approach of Torah Umada, it's not just validating that Torah has validity and Mada has validity. There also has to be an integration. We have to be comfortable and understand the parts of our lives that the role that science plays, the role that Torah plays, and the fact that they are complementary and not in conflict. It will help us develop an integrity of a spiritual outlook. And as I mentioned, we'll see in the next class, it will help us dramatically in taking on successfully and integrating scientific new scientific realities into the framework of halacha. If they're not viewed as competing entities, but rather as complementary entities, it's a lot easier to synthesize the two than it is if you view them as competing and threatening entities, in which case you want to keep the two of them as far away as possible. So I guess I can take